Lately, I've been really trying to upgrade my wardrobe, leaning into pieces that feel effortless, comfortable, and flattering. That's why my go-to is Quince. Their fabrics feel elevated, the fits are flattering, it just works. My latest additions to my wardrobe have been their lightweight cotton cashmere link stitch dolman sweater and French terry wide leg pants. They both fit me so well, and that's not always easy. I just love how all the colors mix and match and feel so chic without breaking the bank. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And that's because Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/POR for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/POR for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/POR. Your home is more than just furniture. It's an extension of you. And even small details like a rug can completely change how a space feels. I love Ruggable because they prove you should never have to choose between a home that looks great and one that's actually livable. Our living room rug was looking a bit dirty lately, so we decided to get a new one from Ruggable. I was instantly drawn to their plush all-in-one rugs because I just love a soft texture, especially when watching TV on the couch. We went with the Finley Smoke Gray plush rug. It's really made our space feel so much cozier, and I love that you can just throw it in the wash when needed. It's been so much easier to keep this rug clean because we're often guilty of eating while watching TV, and we need a rug that suits our lifestyle. If you're looking for a high-quality look that's stain-resistant, machine-washable, and has built-in non-slip backing, then Ruggable is for you. Refresh your home with Ruggable.com. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with promo code POR at Ruggable.com. That's Ruggable.com and use code POR at checkout. I'm Julie Krafcik.
And I'm Yue Xu. This is The Psychology of Relationships. How do you actually know if someone's a good match for you? Not just on paper, not just on a first date, but in a way that lasts. In this episode, we're joined by Eli Finkel, social psychologist and director of the Relationships and Motivation Lab at Northwestern University, to unpack what compatibility really means and to challenge many of the assumptions we've been taught about choosing a partner. Because while shared interests, similar personalities, and instant chemistry can feel important early on, they're actually not the strongest predictors of long-term relationship satisfaction. We explore the psychology behind why compatibility isn't something you simply find, but something you build. Eli introduces the Michelangelo effect, the idea that the healthiest relationships are ones where partners help shape each other into their best, most fulfilled selves. Rather than asking, are we the same? The better question becomes, do we help each other grow? Through research-backed insights, Eli explains how attraction, alignment, and compatibility evolve over time, especially when both partners are willing to invest intentionally. Whether you're dating, deciding whether to commit, or reflecting on your current relationship, this episode offers a grounded, science-informed way to rethink compatibility, one that's less about perfection and more about possibility. Remember to subscribe to The Psychology of Relationships on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if this episode helped you rethink what really matters in love, we love a rating or review. This is The Psychology of Relationships, and you're listening to an episode that just might change the way you show up for love. Enjoy. Welcome, Eli, to discuss one of the most debated topics we've ever had. Compatibility. How do you choose the right partner? How do you know you're with the right partner? And we keep going back and forth, but you've devoted a lot of research into this topic. So it's nice to have an expert versus just me and Julie giving our opinions.
I'm delighted to be back. It's always fun visiting with you too.
We love having people like you to scientifically back up a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about. And I think like one piece that I found really interesting that you've quoted before is that like initial compatibility, like shared interests or having similar personalities, isn't actually as strong of a predictor of long-term relationship satisfaction as we may think. Why is this the case?
Yeah. And look, I was surprised by this. I mean, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, you know, how important is it to be with somebody who has similar hobbies as you or similar personalities or compatible personalities and even, even things like values, these effects are much smaller than I would have anticipated. So how could it be that people have such strong instincts that similarity is crucial and yet the evidence is so weak? And I think the most foundational reason for that is that perceived similarity is a huge effect. Like if you're trying to predict how much I like a girl I went on a date with, and you ask me, like, how much did the two of you have in common? That will be a huge predictor of how much I'm into her. But that is not an objective measure of compatibility. And what we've learned, I mean, really over the last 20 years, we've incrementally put the pieces together on this, is when we meet somebody, we go through some sort of conversational process. We, you know, explore this terrain of the conversational space and that terrain of the conversational space. We touch on these various topics. And especially insofar as there's some sort of spark, we lean really heavily into that tiny fraction of the conversational space where we're laughing together, we're having a good time. And so afterward, we have some feeling about whether we're compatible with someone, but we base it on a very specific subset of the possible space. So it feels like we have a lot of similarity, but we could have focused on the other 98% of the space, and maybe we weren't similar there at all. We just focused on a very small subset and drew conclusions.
And can we take that a step further? Is it because when people have this perceived similarities with someone, they become lazier in getting to know them? And kind of where I'm going with this is that I read that when you speak a second language, you actually exercise more of your empathy muscles when you speak in that language, because you're more careful about the words that you choose. But when you speak your native language, you default to what you normally speak in. So there's less empathy. And I do wonder if you just assume someone's so similar to you, you exercise less of those muscles of getting to know them as a newer person, and you can default some of these perceptions.
Boy, that is an interesting idea. I don't know that we can speak to it based on the evidence, but let me comment on a related idea. This idea of like how much effort are you putting in to not only making the connection, but really like making an impression of someone. And the truth is that when we have a confident assessment of the person, regardless of whether it's positive or negative, we kind of turn off our assessment instruments. And this is actually a pretty important thing that we do when we're developing trust in a significant other or in a friend or in a coworker or whatever. One of the ways that you can think about trust is as a matter of faith, as a matter of I'm no longer monitoring, I'm no longer keeping track, I'm no longer paying attention to what you're out doing. I just know as a matter of faith that you're out there doing good stuff for me. And that is a version of this idea of like turning off the effort that is probably beneficial most of the time. You're no longer having to do this careful calculus because you know the person's out there doing good stuff. Now, one other thing I should mention in this space is when we're first meeting people, we draw impressions really fast. Those impressions matter regardless of whether they're accurate. That is, if in those opening moments, I traversed down this part of the conversational terrain and you were like, oh yeah, I saw that movie. That was so funny. And I say, yeah. I know, don't you love the scene where we something, something? Then what we'll do is we'll interpret the rest of the interaction from this really positive, rosy glow perspective and incorporate all the new information into this positive or perhaps into this not so positive earlier impression.
They're like, I don't ever want to have a relationship. And you're like, that sounds amazing. Thank you.
but we both love this movie. We must be meant to be.
I mean, your listeners have been there. They've been on a date and within the first 3 minutes, they're like, okay, like how long until I can say, oh boy, would you look at the time. And at that point, they're mostly not forming new impressions. They're not engaging in any sort of careful assessment anymore. They know that this one isn't going to work, or they're very excited that it is going to work. And then they interpret the rest of the interaction in accord with those early impressions.
So I remember I had a friend that was like really excited about this guy that she met. And she's like, he went to the same type of boarding school as me. He grew up on the East Coast. I don't know what other surface level type similarity they had. It was like this whole list of things. And I'm like, you've only known this guy for like 10 minutes, right? You met out at like a bar. Like, how do you know this person? Why do you think like our mind jumps there? Is it just like easier to like find those things because they're more tangible? Like whether like instead of like, are they a good person or are they reliable? Like what's kind of the reason we go there?
So there is this sort of good on paper idea of like what we think will make a good fit for us. And in fact, if you ask people, they have no difficulty telling you what are the attributes they're looking for in a partner. And it could be we went to the same sort of boarding school. It could be I want somebody who's extroverted or somebody who's kind or somebody who's sexy, right? Like we've done a bunch of research in this space, actually mostly spearheaded by Paul Eastwick, your good friend, Paul. And, you know, the assumption is that I know what I'm talking about. You ask me, like, what sorts of things appeal to you in a woman? And I'll tell you confidently, like, these are the sorts of things that really matter. But what you can do, these are actually empirical questions you can actually test. All right, so now you introduce me to a whole bunch of women. So for example, we've run speed dating events, right? And people in our studies report, like, what are the qualities that matter to you in a partner? Then we introduce you to 12 people of your preferred sex. And we know the extent to which those people actually match versus mismatch the characteristics that you said were particularly important. So how much does it matter that the man I introduced you to happens to align versus misalign with the characteristics that you said were really important to you? It matters very little. Like, it's more than zero. Having somebody match your preferences is better than like literally nothing, but it is a very small amount of what's going to make you feel a sense of connection together and what's going to make your relationship successful.
And maybe that's the follow-up. Like, clearly, like, you can't have zero, right? Like, you can't have no chemistry at all or no attraction or nothing in common, but we don't need a lot. Like, what's kind of that line of like the tipping point of what matters?
Oh, so those are, when you sort of summarize that, I see two different things in what you were saying.
Okay.
So you said in the front end, like no attraction. And then you said something like, you know, compatibility on paper. Attraction matters tremendously, right? Like, you could imagine that we lived in some other culture or in the, you know, Middle Ages when marriage was like about political alliances and like who grew the best maize or corn or something like that. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world where, to a very significant extent, we're going to require that we feel a sense of love for the person, and usually at least some level of a sense of passion. So it's absolutely crucial, given the way we think about the way, for example, serious relationships or marriage should work, given our current cultural context, it's crucial that we have attraction. The question is, what predicts that attraction? Mm. Could you know in advance, like if you were the smartest social scientist ever with the best measures ever, to what extent could you take like self-reports or like body odor or whatever it is and use all that information collectively to say, you, Julie, are going to be really into Dave and not really that into John? And the answer is mostly not. Not that you won't have attraction to one or the other, but the extent to which is predictable based on information that you could know in advance is very, very small. Mm. To be clear, especially on a first meeting, there is some amount of consensus about like who's hot. Right? Like, I mean, your audience knows this, right? They know that like some people are hotter than other people. Now, that doesn't mean there's like total consensus. Some people are like, no, I think he's really good looking. And your friend says, no, I don't think he's that good looking. That's obviously real too. But on a first meeting, there's some amount of consensus about who's physically attractive. But remember, that's not really the problem that we're trying to solve. And it's certainly not the problem that, you know, online dating services are trying to solve, is like finding the hot guy, right? What they're trying to say is like, who's compatible with you, Julie, more than with you, UA? And that's the thing that's really hard to predict in advance. The compatibility, some aspect of the two of us together, independent of who you are and who I am. And I think in principle, it is mostly unknowable, because most of attraction, beyond the fact that some people are hot and you like interacting with them in the first few minutes, most of attraction is due to something that emerges as we start chatting and interacting with each other.
So if I'm hearing this right, attraction feeds into compatibility. It doesn't determine compatibility.
It does not determine it. But I think, the way I think about attraction is it is an early indicator of compatibility. Or another way to say it is compatibility when you're first interacting with somebody is attraction. That's basically what it is. Like, I feel into you and that is special, right? I'm more into you at the speed dating event than I am into the other women. And you're more into me at the speed dating event than you are with the other men. I'm happy, for lack of a better word, to call that compatibility, that there's some like unique connection that two of us have at the speed dating event. Separate from that is what has caused that compatibility, and was it knowable as a function of like my biography and personality and values and your background as well? Or is it knowable in advance?
Oh my God, I have so many questions. I have one. Okay, I'll go with this question. If that's the case, do you think attraction is only determined by comparison Like, could I be attracted to someone in silo and there are no other viable partners for me? Or it is really in comparison to the other people I have as potential.
Boy, this is another thought-provoking question. So, maybe an odd way to start answering this one is, I think we could be attracted to most people. And here, I think you have to do like the desert island experiment, right? Yeah. So like if she were or he were the only person there.
Well, yeah. Like the Bachelor.
The Bachelor. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Now, those people are pre-selected to be physically good.
That's right. Sure.
But if you sort of took a random draw from the population, and let's imagine these were, you know, a heterosexual man and a heterosexual woman, but just like a random draw from the population, they speak the same language, let's imagine, you know, how plausible is it that they could, you know, fall for each other? And here I mean, feel some level of sexual desire for each other, some level of romantic connection for each other. Highly likely. Like, I bet most of us could find a way to be like, yeah, you know what? I'm kind of into her. So in that sense, I suppose you could say it's comparative in that sense. Like if it's the only person around, you sort of make do. And remember, this like desert island example is crazy in one sense, but you don't have to go that far into the past before you get to the time when most people married somebody like on their block, right? So, you know, go back 100 or 200 years and it was just standard to marry one of the, I don't know, 5 or 10 people who happened to be nearby. That was just a totally standard way this stuff happened. Now, what about this inherent comparison stuff in the age of the apps, in the age of urban living and romantic ideologies? I don't know what to say. Yes, I do think that we're in some calculating process of trying to figure out like who's appealing for us. I'm more into this guy than I am into that guy. I think those things happen. One thing that makes me really happy that human psychology fixes this problem for most of us most of the time, because when we're in love with a partner, when we're highly committed to a partner, we're not looking. Right? I don't want to be Pollyannish. I'm aware that affairs happen. I'm aware that people who are happy can be seduced. I'm aware of all of those things. But if somebody is in a happy relationship, the fact that she could open Tinder and there's like thousands of guys there is irrelevant. Not because those guys don't exist, but because when she's happy, she's not looking.
Yeah. So maybe this is a good time to define compatibility, because I think what I'm hearing is like short-term compatibility is one thing. Like we have chemistry, we connect on the superficial like this, and then there's long-term compatibility of what sets us up for a relationship that could last for years and years, and marriage or even life partner, whatever it may be. And is the word even compatibility for that? Like how do you define those two?
Yes, you are exactly right. I think of compatibility as what makes two people more into each other. So early on, that could be like craving a kiss. And later on, it could be like happily married or whatever. Above and beyond how happy I am with a given partner, above and beyond how happy I would be with like some other partner, and above and beyond how happy she would be with some other partner. So I think of compatibility as some unique specialness that makes us connect with each other above and beyond just like the way we would connect with some, you know, random draw from the population or the second best option or something like that. I think the way lots of people talk about compatibility, and this might be the standard definition, and it might be what you guys are using, is what we sometimes talk about in terms of like gears or puzzle pieces that like fit or don't fit. So you are a gear of a certain size, and like the teeth on the edges of the gears are like a certain width.
And they're sharp.
And they are sharp, and they are fierce, and you do not want to get cut. So you are looking for somebody who is also like the right size gear. And so that when you like start rotating, he sort of rotates right into those grooves and doesn't get cut by your sharp gears. And that's one way of thinking about compatibility. In the work that Paul Eastwick and I have done in this space, and other people too, we've become skeptical that that's what compatibility is, or at least that that's how it works if you're trying to predict relationship happiness. That most of what actually makes relationships good, and in the definition that I'm using, compatible, is not finding the person whose like puzzle piece fits your puzzle piece or whose gear aligns with your gear. That's a way of thinking about compatibility. And it could have been that that's really what predicts happiness. I was totally open to that. 20 years ago, I would have just assumed that the answer was yes. But what we are finding is that the vastly larger influence on how happy people are in their relationship, I might call that also compatibility, is what they have cultivated together. That is the extent to which we have really chosen to like lean into those parts of the possible compatibilities that make us happiest and the parts where we have the best strengths and where we fight the least. And we've downregulated or downgraded the centrality of things that we might have thought were important to us, but that we always fight about. We've just decided like, okay, we're not good at that. And we're going to stop fighting about those things. And we're going to lean in on these other things, like calling each other like cute pet names and having in jokes and like looking across the party at each other and knowing like, oh, you want to leave, or oh, you just picked up a good piece of gossip. Those aren't things that are knowable. Those aren't things that you know, you just look at the gears on the shelf and like pick two gears that fit. No, it's a process of getting acquainted and leaning into our strengths and leaning away from our limitations and working to become compatible over time. That's the way I think about compatibility.
I want to dive into this even more, but before we do, let's take a quick break to hear from our partners.
Okay, we talk a lot on the show about attraction, relationship dynamics, and why we fall for people who are completely wrong for us. And this book captures all of that. I just finished reading Behind Closed Doors by Shane Rose, and I could not put it down. It's so spicy, suspenseful, and genuinely addictive. So here's the setup. A woman's life gets turned upside down when danger finds her at work, and suddenly she's whisked away to an ultra-private billionaire enclave as the live-in nanny for this brooding, powerful, impossible, possibly magnetic single dad. Forced proximity, a secret society, and a hero who is protective, possessive, and very much off limits. The tension? Absolutely unhinged in the best way. As someone who loves studying relationship dynamics, this push and pull in this book hits different because it's not just romance. There's real suspense and secrets unraveling the whole time. It's think Desperate Housewives meets spicy dark romance. Behind Closed Doors by Shane Rose, book one of the Kept in Paradise series, is on sale now wherever books are sold in print and ebook. Staying present in a relationship might be really difficult sometimes because it's not just one date. It's every night on the couch, every meal, every wait, what did you just say? Moment. That's where Brick comes in. Brick is a simple device that helps you put boundaries around your phone so you can actually be with your partner. You just pair the device to your phone and it locks distracting apps, and suddenly you're not half listening while trying to reply to texts or checking Instagram. Now, it's not about cutting out technology. It's about choosing presence during dinner, before bed, or when you're having a real conversation that deserves your full attention. Because relationships don't fall apart from one big thing. They fade from too many small moments of distraction. If you want to be more present with your partner, check out Brick. Go to getbrick.app/POR show for 10% off. That's getbrick.app/POR show. So sounds like there are really two phases of compatibility. You can have immediate compatibility with someone, just given your gears fit, but that's not something you work towards. It's just luck. And then there is efforted compatibility that is created and developed over time. And that's a compatibility we should put more weight on.
Yes, but even that early stuff is not as much about gears. It's just like we've looked. So for example, the similarity stuff. So when I you know, say to you or say on the air here that, you know, similarity is just not that big. And people are like, well, what the hell are you talking about? Like, you know, of course it is. Let me just be clear about what we mean. We're often talking about the initial compatibility stuff, the initial attraction stuff. We're actually talking about like at a speed dating event or after a first date, you know, that you get set up on a blind date. How into people are you as a function of how similar are your big five personality attributes? What are your hobbies? Things that feel like they'd have to be, of course, these things would have to predict how well we got along. But that, even that initial spark, again, it's not nothing. Like a little bit more similarity is a little bit associated with better compatibility, defined as like, I was really into her when we first met and she was really into me when we first met. But those effects even then are pretty small because already I tried the conversational gambit that's like, hey, like, look at this. We're at a speed dating event. That's kind of goofy, right? And you're like, I know, like I always thought speed dating was like the bottom of the barrel, but here I am. And like, I laugh at that. And then I say, have you ever seen The 40-Year-Old Virgin? And you're like, I know, I was talking about that last night, but I might have said, said, have you seen The 40-Year-Old Virgin? And you're like, nope, didn't see it. And then you end up in this like mucky puddle of reboots where you're just trying to find something. And it's like the conversational space is big enough that you could have hit on any number of things. You two know that Paul Eastwick and I have this movie podcast called Love Factually, which again, I hope some of your listeners will check it out. Good. Thank you. Thank you. But 500 Days of Summer, I think, really drives home some of the absurdity of these ideas that feel so intuitive to us is he's convinced that he's in love with Summer, right? This is Tom. He's totally in love with Summer. And his, you know, consigliere, basically his the person he trusts the most is his, I think, 12-year-old sister who's like, look, just because some girl likes the same crazy stuff you like doesn't mean you're compatible. But that part of it, I think, is already in the movie. But my to ruin the end of the movie, turn the volume down for a second if you don't want a spoiler here. At the end, he eventually, Summer breaks up with him. He eventually meets Autumn. What do they talk about? Like, what is it that they talk about that makes them feel like, oh my God, like the gods have sent us to each other. How could we be this compatible? It's because they both have the same feeling about a parking lot at a club.
Right.
Right. They're like, oh, that parking lot, it's terrible. And what do they conclude from that? Can you believe how much we have in common? You think any researcher could have assessed that in advance? No. Like, well, how do you feel about the parking lot at 3800 Davis Street? These things are the vast, vast array of things we could talk about. We get lucky and we hit on some of them. And then when we do, we laugh and we bring out the best in each other and things go smoothly. But there's a lot of randomness in those opening moments.
So in that example, though, is that because they've come up with like this shared language and culture that you were talking about does help predict, or is it really just happenstance?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but they chose it.
Yeah. Hmm.
There was nothing special about that. Right. That parking lot. That parking lot is, in fact, not special at all. But to them, it is hugely special. And that's what I mean when I say compatibility is something you build.
Yeah.
You decide. Also, in that movie, there's another great example. When he's still with Summer, they go to the IKEA.
Yeah.
You know, they're still, like, walking around the IKEA. I think they actually, like, get on the bed.
Yeah, I love that scene. Yeah.
I think they, like, sort of act like it's their house or something. And it's adorable. And it's great for their relationship. And the devastating moment, or one of the devastating moments in that movie, is they're back at IKEA and he's doing his half of their shtick, their little microculture, and she's not.
Yeah.
And that's a devastating moment for him and a devastating moment for the relationship, because not because they're both IKEA lovers, not because you could have looked at a bunch of gears in advance and like chosen like Tom IKEA lover and Summer IKEA lover, but because the two of them had these experiences together and chose to sort of lean in to these special, unique, idiosyncratic things that they themselves do that are like the definition of us, the definition of like who we are as a couple. And that, to me, is the compatibility that you develop even in those opening moments and you continue to earn over time to the degree that you continue to prioritize it.
You always got to make fun of me, but I feel like this was something that was definitely different in my current relationship.
Huh?
Was even from the early stages, like we had like these like, I don't know, stickers that we sent to each other. Like, cute. They were so
digital,
cheesy.
Stickers.
Digital. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like,
well,
through text.
I assume she wasn't sending them through UPS. Like,
throwing them in the mail. And
that would be awesome, though.
I would get, that would be a microculture.
I would want stickers in the mail. Yes.
Seriously.
But they seemed so, like, trivial at the time. But, like, looking back, I was like, actually, they did really, like, make this bond, that, like, this kind of inside thing. And I think that was actually, like, very apparent from the early stages, which was different than other relationships.
You know, it's interesting. Not only like as you look back, is it like, I don't know why it was, you know, such a big deal. Sometimes these things are like incomprehensible from the outside.
Yeah.
I remember with my wife, maybe like 10 or 15 years ago, we had my stepsister and stepbrother-in-law over. And, you know, we adore them. They were over at our house and Allison, my wife, did something. And I said something, oh, you fucked up. And he was like, his jaw dropped a little bit. He was like, oh my God, like, why would you sort of be so disrespectful? But, and she had to say, like, no, that's not what this is. He doesn't mean it at all like that. This is how we talk to each other. It could not possibly be more affectionate than like you fucked up. Yeah. But it is inexplicable from the outside. But if I stopped saying it, or my wife stopped saying it to me, it would be a bad sign for the relationship.
Yeah, we have like catchphrases too. That's so funny. I mean, I guess this is like the part that I know you've done a ton of research on, like online dating and dating apps and how like this stuff doesn't really come through there. And that's why we're like focused mm-hmm. on the similarities and the surface mm-hmm. level interests and like the stuff that maybe isn't this. But like, how do you actually vet for this in the world that we're in today? Or is there no way?
Shaking
Let me
head.
Say. I mean, I don't think you can vet for this. But before I throw the entire industry under the bus, because I am about to do
that. Brace yourself.
Let me send them like a short love letter, like a short bunch of stickers through the mail.
Yeah. Something positive first. Yeah,
exactly.
Stickers.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm doing. They are... The existence of the industry is tremendous. It is like the people who are complaining about it have a bunch of justifiable complaints, but they probably don't have much feel for what it was like to be single and sad about being single in like 1985, but it's long past the time when your friends are setting you up with people. And it was like most of us, most of the time can use the apps or whatever else to go on a date. And that is worth so yes. much. When your immediate social environment isn't delivering you a bevy of options, there's other options. And I just can't praise it mm-hmm. enough for that.
100%.
That said,
here comes the middle of the sandwich.
Yeah. One of the big problems that the industry has had from the start is, at least early on, like with early match or whatever else, it was like thousands. It was like, how many people are within, you know, 25 miles of zip code, whatever? And like the human brain doesn't do that. It's not like we're good at looking at, you know, 3,000 profiles and picking out who's like compatible with us. Again, you can look at photos and say that person's hotter, right. assuming mm-hmm. that it's like a fair photo of themselves. That you can do. But like, who's going to be more compatible with me than with the next person? You cannot do it. And once you're above like 5 or 10, they all start to like run together anyway. Mm-hmm. The second thing the industry did. Oh, so I think this idea that you can like show people enough profiles and they can find someone compatible with you. Yeah. That's false. The second thing that they tried to do, understanding that that's false, and this was mostly eHarmony was the first to do this, is they said, we've got an algorithm. Mm-hmm. Like you don't have to do it because yep. we've done it right. for you. We're yep. going to find the 5 people yep. out of our thousands that are uniquely compatible with you. And look, I was excited mm-hmm. about that. They were making those claims in 2000. Yeah.
Seems like a good promise, right?
It seems like a good promise. And as somebody who studies this and thinks like, I don't know, it'd be sort of awesome to make millions on something. I was like, yeah, we should be able to do this stuff. The problem is we can't. The problem is, for the reasons that we've been talking about earlier, when they claim they can set you up with your soulmate, they're lying. If they're claiming like we can, you know, eliminate the drug abusers and, you know, then they can do that. But that's very different from we're going to find your soulmate. So why are online dating sites, online dating services more generally so useful? Because they provide opportunities to get across a cup of coffee or a pint of beer from somebody to find out, is there anything here that would warrant me, you know, doing a second opportunity, a second date together? And I think you can tell at least reasonably quickly whether there's any spark at all, which I think should be the threshold, not like tons of spark, but like any spark at all, I think is a good threshold for like, yeah, that's worth a second try. How do you do that? Well, look, I don't love how much emphasis the industry places on photographs. I mean, it's true that like what I like about the industry are places where it's egalitarian. So it's really, really great for gay people. It's been better for gay people than for straight people, and especially for gay people in communities where it's not that easy to be gay. That's something I love about the industry. One thing I don't love nearly as much is the people who are hot, or at least the people who have hot photos on their profile, which may not be exactly the same thing.
Nope.
They are...
cleaning up.
They get much more attention. And so I don't love how much emphasis it places on looks. The best thing to do is just figure out a way to get face to face with somebody for at least a brief check-in, and then see, like, if there's absolutely nothing there, then okay. But if you're like, I don't know, there's some non-zero shot, then try a second date and see how that plays out.
I mean, UA and I are probably among the few in this space that don't tell you to like spend a lot of time on a profile. We're actually like, send 30 seconds, get a gut feel, and then filter through the conversation, because you can tell nothing from the photo, like outside
basically
of it.
Nothing.
But we hear a lot of people spending astronomical amount of time micro-analyzing every last thing in a profile and spending hours and hours on their own profile. And our motto is like, if it's a maybe, it's a yes. Invite them to your house party and see if you guys jive. House party, like figuratively. But yes, that's kind of like, we're on the same boat. So it's good to know your take on that alliance.
And maybe I just want to think about something actionable for our listeners, because the challenge we always hear with dating apps is even taking the conversation off the apps. People feel like, oh, this conversation's going nowhere. We've had people who come to us and ask for a list of questions to ask through messaging because they don't know how to facilitate that conversation, or just not feeling excited after a conversation.
Yeah.
But I think what you two were saying with kind of the shared language and inside jokes, maybe that's an opportunity for connection and building compatibility, even in the earlier messaging stage. Yeah. And what you said was interesting, Eli. It takes someone just leaning in to that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I call it kind of like a bid for a connection. Yeah. If someone's making that bid, the other person can lean in. Mm-hmm. Maybe for our listeners, take those opportunities to lean in. One great example is my friend was messaging with someone on a dating app and he spelled fuck like duck, like many of us, you know, autocorrect do. So she sent back this duck emoji.
Yeah, that's great.
And then he sent a bunch of ducks. And then after they started dating, they actually dated for a while. Every time they had a bad day or was feeling frustrated, they sent a duck. And that became their mutual language. But that really started in the messaging stages.
Yeah.
So maybe for all of our listeners, here's something to do today is find those bits for connection and lean into it and see what happens.
Yeah. You know, this thing of like, how do we make dates better? I think there's like two answers here. One is nobody set a rule that you had to do the resume exchange. Now, I just described the resume exchange. I just described going, you know, for a cup of coffee or whatever. But there's no rule on that. Like you could do something that you would enjoy doing even if it were by yourself or even if it were with somebody that were kind of a dud, right? So there's no rule that says you have to have the resume exchange dates. The other thing is like not that many ideas from like the academic literature on relationships go viral. But the 36 questions have gone viral.
And yes.
At this point, there's like no excuse to have a really boring first conversation. Like, look up the 36 questions if you want. It's funny. Paul was in I might have told you guys the story. So my first year as a professor at Northwestern, I'm finishing my 22nd year now. But my first year here as a professor was Paul Eastwick's first year as a graduate student. And I was teaching a PhD course on close relationships. And he was saying, well, how do people get into these relationships? Like, okay, great. Like once you're in a relationship, like here's how forgiveness works and here's what commitment is and all those things that we were talking about. But like, how does initial attraction work? How does early relationship development work? And that kept coming up. And so the students, unbeknownst to me, figured out that there was a speed dating event that was going to be coming to Chicago the next week. And like this, this was pre-iPhone. Like I didn't have anything with me to know about this. So by the time I got home, it was like 2 a.m, I'd gone out that night. By the time I got home, they had found a date that we were all going to go speed dating. Hmm. And I actually brought a note card that had like high intimacy questions on one side of the note card and low intimacy questions on the other side of the note card. And you could imagine doing something similar on your dates, although only use the high intimacy questions on the note card.
Interesting. You know, this is all like clicking for me too, because we've talked about like the date review, which is what you meant by like the resume like exchange.
Yeah. Yep.
I've used this example before, but like one of the best dates I had with a past partner was like when we just talked about pranks we pulled on each other for like the first hour. And it wasn't the resume exchange date review. And it makes sense now like why that worked. And I think like I wasn't able to like put that together before. I think we're just like, get rid of the date review. But now you're hearing straight from Eli that this is the science telling you to like actually focus on those shared moments and that building that microculture more.
And those questions, I mean, those are questions that are pretty intimate. So some of them might be like more intimate than those 36 questions. Some of them might be more intimate than you want to be. But there's plenty in there that should be well within the comfort zone for people on a first date in a given cultural context. There's not that much reason to spend that much time being like, so where'd you go to college? And then like, what did you do next? Like maybe you'll get lucky and be like, oh my God, my best friend went to that same college. Did you pledge a fraternity? Oh my God, like my friend was in that. Like, great. That's great. You got lucky in the, you don't have to do the mucky puddle of reboots, you know, in the conversation world. But there's a bunch of things that people actually say something new and interesting. And it just puts an upper limit on how, you know what it does? It puts a lower limit on like a boredom thing. It's just, you're having real conversation with a real person about real topics, as opposed to fake conversations with a real person about fake topics.
Do you remember one or two of the questions from the list? I'm forgetting them.
I think I remember like the highest intimacy questions. These things go incremental. I think they start with things like, you know, what is one of your favorite hobbies? Which is frankly good enough. It's way better than being like, so how long have you lived in Chicago or whatever?
Right.
And it ends with, oh, I think it's like, you know, which celebrity do you admire the most? I think it ends with things like, you know, of all the people you know whose death would upset you the most. Mm-hmm. And by the way, just so you know, by the way, I'm not recommending that one necessarily for a first date. You don't have to go to the group three. There's three groups that are, it goes in increasing intimacy. But I will tell you that this is a research paradigm in my world. It's almost three decades old at this point. And over the course of 45 minutes, they run people through these like three sets of questions, and people feel massively closer. Massively closer. Now, that's a really cool research tool for us, because if you want to run experimental studies where some people are randomly assigned to the high closeness condition and some people are randomly assigned to the low closeness condition, we have tools for doing that. But if the only thing you want to do is have dates that are less boring, I blame you. If you're going out and having boring dates, do like 5 minutes of sleuthing online to find out what the 36 questions are, and you come equipped with a few interesting questions.
I mean, the key too is not having this like predefined answer we're looking for, because I think that also happens in the date review. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just thinking of like, what's your hobby? What we were saying earlier, you don't need the hobby to be aligned with your hobby.
Not at all.
You just need to understand and like hear the person out and appreciate what they're bringing to the table and use it as a conversation starter.
You know, again, I think about movies a lot, and I think about relationships in movies a lot. And one of the movies we've covered on Love Factually, and one of my favorites, is La La Land.
Uh-huh.
And with regard to what you're saying, the Ryan Gosling character is obsessed with jazz.
Yep.
And the Emma Stone character, they meet and they're like walking around and there's nothing yet, but like kind of intrigued maybe. And she says, I need to get this out of the way right away. I hate jazz. Or like, I dislike jazz. Yeah. She says like Kenny G. Now we know earlier, because Ryan Gosling's character was talking with his sister. His sister was trying to set him up with a girl. And he said, does she like jazz? And the sister was like, probably not. And he said, well, what would we have to talk about?
Yeah.
And your point, and for anybody who's seen the movie, Ryan Gosling's character and Emma Stone's character never stop talking. They have endless stuff to talk about, because it turns out that it doesn't matter to her whether the guy's interested in jazz. She thinks she's not into that, but then he's into jazz and he's exciting about jazz. And the way he talks about jazz is kind of thrilling. And he takes her to a jazz show and he gets to see what she likes about it. You don't need somebody prepackaged with your interests. You need somebody with interests, and you need to like be excited about what they're excited about. And that's not that hard to do, as long as people actually are excited about something.
Oh my God. That's a red flag if someone doesn't have interest.
It would be a hard one for me.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be like, look, I don't care. Are you interested in astronomy? Are you interested in bugs? Like, I would be indifferent.
Yeah, bugs.
It has to be something.
Stickers, whatever.
Stickers. Yeah.
So I did have one person once that I like talked to on like a video call that basically like said that he didn't think it was worth meeting up because I wasn't into sci-fi enough.
Yeah.
Like, what? I mean, I think it's like kind of short-sighted, but at the end of the day, like if that's like all you do, like is that important that you find someone? Like what's the line?
No.
You're like, no.
No, it's, I mean, look, he's welcome to limit his dating pool however he wants. And if he feels like he's in a climate of abundance and he can just toss out reasonable people because, you know, they don't know their, you know, Ray Bradbury's, that's totally fine. I'm not judging him. Do I think that the extent to which he will feel like initial attraction to somebody is particularly affected by whether she also likes sci-fi? No, that effect is almost certainly going to be small. We know this. Again, I'm not saying this is intuitive. Yeah. I did not have this intuition. I'm basing this on 20 years of evidence. And do I think that he's going to need sci-fi to be happy with like a long-term partner? Also, no. Right? This idea that it has to be your romantic partner that you share your primary hobby with? No, nobody ever decided that. And I would ask him, if he wanted advice from me, I would ask him, why do you think it's so important that your romantic partner, your primary romantic partner, whatever he's seeking, also be a sci-fi person? Like, couldn't it be totally reasonable that she's interested in other stuff and you guys end up going to plays? And yet, there's still plenty of time in your life where you do sci-fi conventions and you have sci-fi reading groups. And it turns out that this person that you're with now is like a really good caregiver and a really good parent, right, and really good in bed, but like doesn't like Ray Bradbury. Seriously? You're going to rule that person out? It strikes me as short-sighted.
So I guess where is the line though for lifestyle? Because we hear people say like, I want someone with a compatible lifestyle and maybe also.
Money?
So I guess maybe there's a couple factors here. There's like socioeconomic background, maybe how you spend your time. Like I'm thinking lifestyle, like we have a friend that's obsessed with music festivals and she could not fathom being with someone that didn't go to music festivals because that's how she spends every weekend.
Does she have kids?
No.
I just don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. Like if she thinks she's going to take her 8-month-old to music festivals, I think she's probably wrong. If she thinks that her priorities right now are going to be the same as her priorities when she isn't getting enough sleep, and it's probably going to be pretty important to her that she's with somebody who's like a conscientious parent and a supportive partner, somebody who's really good for her career. Like if I had to guess for her, I don't know her, but if I had to guess.
This is the problem though, is everyone's looking at the moment right now, right?
Now, yeah.
So when we go on dates, we're judging people through a date lens of like, was that fun? Did I enjoy having cocktails and tell you about travel stories? We're not thinking about like, are they going to comfort me when my parent passes? Or like, are they going to be a good parent? Like, how do you start to like shift into that larger picture then?
I don't know that it's that easy to do. I mean, I share your diagnosis of the problem. Let me sort of summarize it in my own words. I think, you know, it's like we sort of sample from life experience, right? Like our life will have a certain array of experiences. And like we're 27 and like we meet somebody and, you know, there's a spark there and then the sex is good. And then we travel to Europe and it's like, oh my God, like we just held hands and made out, you know, on the Seine. And how representative are those experiences of what it will be like to be married to somebody from, say, 30 to 85? Low? Probably not very representative. And for me, I don't think it's an easy fix because first of all, I don't know how easy it is to simulate what's it going to be like when we have a kid and they have a learning disability. Like you're probably going to have some of those things in your future. And I don't think they're easy to simulate. Maybe, you know, there's some trial things you can try like a puppy or like traveling, but not in, you know, fancy hotels, like really going through some stressful things together. You can get a sense of how people cope with very stressful circumstances. But I'm married and I study marriage and I like marriage. I'm not saying everybody has to do it or anything like that. But if you ask me like, you know, about the marriage decision, I mostly would call it a leap of faith. Yeah. I don't think you can really know. And for me, that's both scary and beautiful.
Yeah.
You just decide. I love you. I want to make a life with you. Do I have all the information I need to make an informed choice? I do not. Is one of us going to get a cancer diagnosis? Are we going to have a kid with a learning disability? Is somebody going to have like a totally gorgeous coworker who hits on her? Right? We can't know these things. And so we take a flying leap and we decide we're going to make this work. And that's why when we were talking earlier about the nature of compatibility, for me, it's a whole lot of what we're building. It's a whole lot of, are we creating a unique entity, not you plus me, but us? Something that doesn't exist in you and doesn't exist in me. It only exists as the two of us. And then do we cultivate it? Do we water it? Do we nurture it? Do we feed it? Do we lean in to try to keep building it over time? That is the way to have a successful marriage. And at least in the way I use the term, that is what compatibility is.
Let's hold that thought because we have a quick message from our sponsors.
You may or may not have known this, but we actually got our start with our podcast, Dateable. For the last decade, we've been studying modern dating, having thousands of conversations, hearing the patterns, and seeing what actually works or what doesn't. What started as honest conversations turned into something so much bigger. A book, How to Be Dateable, which was published last year with Simon & Schuster, is everything we wish we knew when we were out there dating. The mindset shifts, the patterns, the real talk no one else is saying. So if you're dating or you have a friend, sister, coworker, whoever who is, go grab a copy at howtobedateable.com or wherever books are sold. You can get audiobook, hardcover, or Kindle edition. Because being dateable isn't about changing who you are. It's about finally understanding how you show up.
So to play devil's advocate, because I actually don't believe what I'm about to say, I don't believe in, but okay. I do want to offer this perspective.
It's not my opinion.
It's not my opinion.
Some people think.
if we're saying like marriage is a leap of faith and you can't predict the future, you got to build this marriage together, why not then just find someone who's obsessed with the same things as you are just to make it easier? Why not just start with that?
No, I agree. I agree. And if you remember, the language I used to talk about this is, it's a good thing, just not by much. And so I totally agree with you that all else equal, that guy should find a sci-fi partner. I totally agree. That might make him, you know, an eighth of a percent point happier in his marriage. I totally agree with you. So there's no harm in finding somebody who has hobbies that align with the dangerous mentality comes when we are ruling people out based on paper. We just limited the pool for ourselves in ways that we think are wise. We think we're saving ourselves time and energy. I doubt it.
So it's like you could find someone that likes to go to music festivals with you, but you have to have more than just that. It has to have that microculture and you have to be building together. It can't just be like solely we go to music festivals and that's like the basis of our connection. Yeah.
The large majority of people who go to music festivals are probably not a good partner for you. And yet, there's some people who go to music festivals who are, and there's a whole lot of people who don't go to music festivals who also are.
So in your book, All or Nothing, The All or Nothing Marriage, you reverse engineer like kind of like the best marriages. And clearly we talked about today, like a big piece of it is building and that culture. Is there other pieces that you feel like are actually the stuff that we really should be looking for, opposed to the stuff we've been talking about that maybe isn't as important, that really does predict that great relationship?
Yeah. The All or Nothing Marriage, it was a book that I wrote when I had this realization that the average marriage has been getting worse over time, over the last few generations, let's say, but the best marriages have been getting better. And what is it that we are doing? What is it that the subset of us who are having some successes are doing that the rest of us can learn from? Yes. So one of the things beyond this microculture thing that I think is valuable is a metaphor that I find very useful for thinking about relationships that are going well is this Michelangelo metaphor that I think both of you are familiar with, that Michelangelo, when he was asked about sculpting, like, what is the sculpting process? He didn't say, well, I'm creating this art. He said he was revealing it, right? The statue, the sculpture is inside the David. Michelangelo's David is inside some block of marble. And all he has to do is like buff and chisel and polish. And then you have David and that's it. Now, look, in some sense, that's true. It's also profoundly modest of probably the greatest sculptor ever to say about his art. But you could think about this also from the perspective of humans, right? So as a metaphor, of course, is not literal, but the idea is that all of us have our like actual self, the like unpolished marble, the unchiseled, unbuffed marble. But we have within us the version that we aspire to be, the more patient version, the funnier version, the kinder version, the more successful version. Some people will bring us closer to that person, and some people will push us further from that.
Yes.
So insofar as we have a sense of the version of us that we love the most, we can assess, like, am I the best version of me around this guy, this girl, right? And I actually ended up, I did end a relationship once in my 20s when I realized that the girl I was dating really liked about me the part of me that's like sort of playful, right? The part that's like goofing around and I guess for lack of a better word, being very playful. I like that part of me too. She liked something nice about me that I also like, but I cared. I was just like trying to be an academic and I'd gotten my PhD and I was on the way to being a serious scholar and I wanted to be liked for that. And she liked me for something nice, something I liked about me. She clearly was trying to praise me, but she liked something about me that wasn't what I really cared about myself. Huh. Now, was this a sufficient reason to break up? Probably not. There were other issues as well, but I do think it's something to keep track of is, do I like me more around this person? Am I growing toward the person I want to be, or is it not really happening that way? That's probably one of the good metrics we can use to evaluate how well the relationship is going.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. I remember dating this guy years and years ago, and we went on this trip together, and I was just so happy on this trip because we were like in this cabin, we're just like by a lake, and I started skipping, and he said something like, stop being a kid. Oh. And this guy was 6 years younger than me. And I remember just thinking like, that's what I want to be. I want to be a kid in this sort of environment. But he was like, no, you're the older one. Stop being a kid. God. Yeah.
He thought he was kidding probably, right?
At first I thought so. And then if you saw him in the moment, you would be yeah, you would change your mind.
Yeah. I mean, that sends a second red flag for me too. First of all, it's like you were loving your little euphoria and for him to stomp on it is no fun. But there's a second one too, which is it sounds like a controlling thing to say.
Oh, he was very controlling.
Yeah. Yes. That would be a red flag for me.
Yeah.
So, okay, clearly as you keep going in the relationship, you can see this. But early stages, I mean, obviously you can see how they what side they bring out of you on even a first date. But how do you like start to like scope this stuff early on?
Well, I think it probably manifests early on in feeling funny is my guess. Feeling feeling heard, feeling intelligent, feeling funny. Like these are things that we feel to some greater or lesser extent on various first interactions, various first dates. And so those are things that, you know, we also, not only do we want to like the other person, we would like to like us with the other person. And I think we can get an early sense of that. Again, I don't want to overstate how much like assessment we should be doing in those opening moments, because I'm pretty enthusiastic about people giving a second date as a general default, only avoiding it when things were just really not at all there.
So yeah, I think like this conversation has been so incredible. There's so many takeaways. I mean, I think one piece is that we do need to give things more time, because time does reveal, you know, we talk about this in our book, actually, with this expectation of love on demand, that it's going to happen immediately. And what I'm hearing from you, Eli, is that the stuff that happens immediately isn't always the right predictors. Mm-hmm. So we do need the time to like actually see what can be built. And I love this concept of like, give that second date or a third date or fourth date, chase that curiosity until you're like, no, this is a no. Mm-hmm. I think this piece around the building the microculture, like this is what we need to do more of. And that's what's lacking today, because dating has become so transactional to like ask the right questions, to find the right partner, and to sniff out all the red flags ahead of time and find all the deal breakers. And we're not saying like put yourself in bad situations, but when we're so, when we're so conscientious though about this stuff, it loses just the organic connection. Like when you go out with friends, you're not like, oh my God, is this red flag happening? Are they going to be this like narcissist and terrible person? You're, you know, enjoying the company and like seeing what evolves. So I think bringing more of that energy is now scientifically backed up, not just you and I saying this. So that makes me happy to hear that from this conversation.
Yeah, I feel so validated. Thank you, Eli. If anything,
I'm delighted.
Great therapy session for both of us. We feel so validated. I think in the similar vein, Julie, I feel the same way as a takeaway. In dating right now, we see each other as like, you are here to entertain me and impress me. Dance, monkey, dance. And if I don't like your dance, I'm going to find the next monkey. But what we're talking about here is building, even if the relationship or the date doesn't last past the first date, how do we still lean in to these conversations to build some sort of connection and maybe compatibility? So dance, monkey, dance. Great. I'm going to now bring out a keyboard. And then you bring out, you start singing. And now we're going to make this into a whole production that's even better than it was before. And it was something we never even imagined from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So if we can all start just leaning in a little bit more, and at the end of your dates, if you're still feeling like, oh, there wasn't much, you have to ask, did I try my best in leaning in to these connections? And if you did, then you have your answer. But if you really didn't, we have to take accountability for that.
Yeah.
I love too putting this gut check of like, how did I feel around this person? Was I showing the best self of me, or the type of person I want to be, the person that comes alive with friends and trusted people? Like, was that coming out on a date? That's so much more important than the resume that this person might have.
Thank you, Eli, for another wonderful discussion. A lot of thought-provoking thoughts in there. So I know
thank
we're
you so
get
much
a
for
lot
having
of messages.
Me.
If people want to find out more about you and your work, where can they go?
They could go to elifinkel.com, or they could check out the podcast at lovefactuallypod.com, where we talk about these ideas as they relate to popular romance movies.
Love it.
Super. And if you haven't done so yet, subscribe to The Psychology of Relationships today so you don't miss an episode.
Bye.